Pope Francis continues to recover from double pneumonia at the Gemelli Clinic in Rome. Pulmonologist and member of the Catholic Medical Association, Dr. Stephen White, shares his perspective on Pope Francis's ongoing health struggles. And the Blaze's Chris Bedford joins us for analysis of President Trump's address to a joint session of Congress and the international trade wars that are heating up. And we'll talk to The Chosen's Jonathan Rumi and with actor and philanthropist Gary Sinise about his late son Mac's legacy and his recently released second album of recorded music. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. You can also find me on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show. Pope Francis continues to recover from double pneumonia at the Gemelli Clinic in Rome since he was admitted on February 14th. According to daily reports from the Vatican, over the past several weeks, the Holy Father seems to be improving with occasional setbacks, and his condition remains guarded. Here to share his perspective on what we know so far is Doctor of Pulmonary Medicine and a member of the Catholic Medical Association, Dr. Stephen White. Dr. White, thank you for being here. Before we start, I need to break in. The Pope released an audio message from the Gemelli Clinic that was played at this prayer gathering, this nightly prayer gathering in St. Peter's Square. I'll play the audience this and allow them to read into it what they will. He says here, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your prayers, for my health from the square. I accompany you from here. May God bless you and the Virgin protect you. Thank you. Listen.
Que Dios lo bendiga. Y que la Virgen cuide. Gracias.
Doctor, what do you hear there, Dr. White? What do you make of that? And is this sort of standard operating procedure when you're dealing with an 88-year-old battling double pneumonia?
I would say yes. I'm not surprised that he's struggling to breathe in the midst of a bilateral pneumonia, meaning pneumonia in both of his lungs, which has now been afflicting him for a minimum of 3 weeks. It's been a very serious illness. It's been, as they repeatedly tell us, complex in light of the fact that he's had other problems, such as renal problems, getting blood transfusions, et cetera. So they probably took him off his support temporarily and allowed him to speak to the world, because we've all been so concerned about him. So I wouldn't read too much into the fact that he's breathless. I would expect that. But again, it does emphasize the fact that he's still not over this and his condition is still tenuous.
The Vatican continues to report that the Pope is using, especially at night, non-invasive mechanical ventilation and supplemental high-flow oxygen during the day. Now, you've been closely following these updates since the Pope fell ill. Explain what's meant by mechanical ventilation. He's not intubated. And based on Francis's current condition, what's your professional take on all of this?
So when he presented to the hospital, he was just on a nasal cannula receiving oxygen, which is, would not be unexpected. But as we have all watched this from day to day, we've watched his condition at times deteriorate significantly. So rather than waiting for him to get worse, they've appropriately begun him on those two means of non-invasive ventilation that you talked about, the nasal cannula, which provides a higher flow of oxygen and some support to his breathing. But then at night when he's sleeping and resting, they take over his ventilation to an extent by using a mask and using positive pressure along with oxygen in order to make it easier for the Pope to breathe and also that he can rest more comfortably. And that also helps to prevent that buildup of secretions that they had to intervene for earlier this week by bronchoscoping him and actually aspirating the secretions for him. So these are all standard forms of therapy in this circumstance, and we shouldn't be surprised by this, But at the same time, when he no longer needs these interventions, we'll be more secure that he's really making a firm, moving in the firmly into a direction of improvement.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there a downside for this, what they're calling mechanized ventilation? Is there a downside for this for someone in this condition who's 88 years old with all the Pope's comorbidities?
No, absolutely not. In fact, it's a move to keep from having to be more interventional, more invasive. You mentioned intubation and mechanical ventilation. That would have harms potentially coming with it. So what they're trying to do is avoid that at all costs, and hopefully he'll be able to recover using only these less minimal, non-invasive means, which are not harmful at all. They only help.
The Vatican's March 6th evening update on Pope Francis' condition reports the following. Pope Francis's condition has remained stable compared to previous days. Today as well, he has not experienced any episodes of respiratory insufficiency. The Holy Father has continued both respiratory and motor physiotherapy with benefit. Hemodynamic parameters and blood tests have remained stable. He has not had a fever. The doctors still maintain a reserved prognosis. In consideration of the stability of his clinical condition, the next medical bulletin will be issued on Saturday, the Vatican Press Office says. Your thoughts on that? And due to the Pope's stability, we're not hearing any further reports, at least, you know, until Saturday. What are your thoughts about the overall update here?
Well, I think it's encouraging. I was particularly concerned on Monday when he had the crisis and then required bronchoscopy. That's usually a pretty clear indication that he's really struggling to manage his own breathing, to manage his own secretions. That could have very easily devolved into a situation where they would have had to make a decision about putting him on actual mechanical invasive ventilation. So I'm very encouraged after that, over the last 48 hours, that the updates have been positive. However, at his age, with the disease that he's experiencing, pneumonia in both lungs and some other systems that have been affected by this, it's certainly appropriate for them to keep us in with regard to his condition being guarded and reserved. He's not out of the woods in a layman's term, so we need to continue to pray on his behalf.
Yeah, well, I've spoken to a number of pulmonologists, and they all say, look, at this, when you're dealing with someone of this age, in his physical condition, this can take sudden turns. That's the term I keep hearing over and over again. Sudden turns you have to expect because that's the nature of what we're dealing with here when it's double pneumonia. Let's look at the Pope's health timeline. Since 2020, I mean, he began having mobility issues with arthritis and sciatica, and he underwent two abdominal procedures, one in 2021, another in 2023, and then the respiratory issues began in 2023 and went on to 2024 when he suffered a severe cold that forced him to bow out of events, eventually leading to his admission to the Gemelli. Give me your professional take on the trajectory of Pope Francis's ailments, really since 2020. This is his third hospitalization for these pulmonary issues.
Yes, third hospitalization for pulmonary issues. And leading up to that, he'd had two major abdominal procedures. He had become immobile, as we know. He'd been in a wheelchair for at least a couple of years. Mobility was diminished. This is a gradual decline in a person's health at his age. I'm actually amazed. It's remarkable that he's been able to continue what must be a very strenuous routine as the Pope, but he has been able to maintain that over the last 2 years. But clearly, this last month has taken a toll on him. And I would agree with your comments about what other pulmonologists have said. You can't tell from hour to hour, day to day, when a turn for the worse could occur. So it wouldn't shock me at all if that happened. But of course, we're all praying, and I'm sure the doctors are working very diligently to try to get him through this. And there's also nothing that would prevent him from recovering from this. He seems to have a man of great reserve and great, patience and perseverance. So again, we pray for his full recovery, but understanding that this is a very fragile situation.
Dr. White, before I let you go, do you have any concern about the Pope's workload during this time in the hospital? And do you foresee him being discharged anytime soon?
Well, with regard to the latter, it will depend entirely on circumstances, although I would say that if over the course of the next several days, week or two, he's not improving considerably, that would certainly diminish our hope that he could recover. In terms of his work, I think it's really outstanding that they're able to keep him mentally and physically active, because we know that people in this circumstance who are put at bed rest and are inactive tend to have a poorer prognosis. So I'm sure they're being very cautious about not overdoing it. It sounds like he's getting plenty of rest, but to enable him to be mentally and physically active is actually to his benefit.
Dr. White, before I let you go, a pulmonologist told me, one close to the scene, that they expect months of hospitalization, not just a few more days, because of the you know, stress on his lungs, one of which is half a lung, and his age. Does that sound right to you?
Yes, and of course the disadvantage that we have in this commentary is that we're not there on the scene. He was struggling to breathe, giving this message that clearly indicates that he's still in a lot of trouble. I think obviously you can't predict the future, correct? But at his age, with an illness this serious, he certainly could be hospitalized for weeks. If that's the case, then the other thing that you could anticipate in terms of his full recovery and rehabilitation, that could be a matter of months. So there'll be some serious considerations that have to be made within the next week or two in terms of his capacities, assuming that he does continue to improve.
Dr. Stephen White, thank you for your insight. We will leave it there. Continue to pray for the Pope, and we'll check in with you in the days ahead. Thank you.
God bless.
This week, President Donald Trump delivered his first address to a joint session of Congress since his return to the White House, with analysis of the speech and the whirlwind of executive action sweeping through D.C. We're joined by political commentator, senior political editor at The Blaze, Chris Bedford. Chris, thanks for being here. I want to start with the president's speech, that joint session of Congress, the first in his second term. He started on a very optimistic note.
Yes, absolutely. He's got a lot to be proud of in there. This is his first speech before a joint session in 5 years. It's unheard of that an administration that was once there and then was out and now is back. And it was kind of a triumphant return for him. And so much over the last 8 years of his agenda has been laid out before the American people. That's one thing that Democrats and their columnist friends have been unable to push back against. He said exactly what he was going to do when he came into office, and he'd already accomplished more in those first 40-something days than any president since FDR had at the beginning of a term. It was a triumphant tone. It was one that was explaining his vision, and it was also, of course, he mixed in some teasing, some humor, and some of those classics from the president.
Yeah, look, YouGov did that poll. Of those watching, 71% of people liked what they heard. So that was clearly he struck a chord with the majority of the audience watching. I was struck, Chris, by the Democrat reaction. I mean, there were the paddle protests during the speech, the outburst by Democratic Congressman Al Green, who was thrown out in the middle. We'll give people a sense of that if they didn't see it. Green has been censured by the House, Chris. I happen to think it important to have an opposition party to hold everybody accountable. But that begins with substantive arguments, not stunts. Where is the Democratic Party now? Are they in a position to make a substantive argument?
No, and they haven't made any arguments really on the substance. If you look at where they're fighting, they've been fighting on legality. They've been fighting on process. When you're talking about deportations, they're not out there talking about illegal immigrants and how they are actually Americans too, like we've been subjected to for the last 8 years. They're simply talking about who has the power and who has the control. The same thing is largely true in the transgender issue, where the last 8 years or so we've been subjected to this insanity. Instead, now they're just saying, well, you can't do this. We're going to follow the law. We're going to follow state law. On all of these issues, they're not fighting on the actual issue itself. And that shows you that Democratic Party that's lost in D.C. Now, the governors, on the other hand, you see them kind of moderate their position. Anyone who's serious out there, who actually wants to have a future in American politics, is doing everything they can to remove the stain of the last 5 years from their political records.
The president spoke at length about the economy. Obviously, this is always an important benchmark for any administration. We're only 6 weeks into this new government. Grocery and energy prices have not moved very much. How vital is economic recovery? And will this trade tariff war with Canada, Mexico, I know we put some of those on hold, and with China, will that help or hinder U.S. economic growth in the near term?
In the near term, it's going to hurt. Any kind of a trade war is going to hurt. And this first term trade war with Canada and blockades over dairy really hit farmers, it hit voters. Who were Trump supporters. And that's something that you saw from the European Union, from Canada and other countries, is they specifically target in their retaliation people who support Donald Trump. And a lot of that's going to be agriculture and things like that. But the sad reality is the American economy has been taken advantage of for so long that the cure is going to be painful. That's difficult. It's easier for a president who's in his last term to do this. But anything they do to try and reset this trade balance is gonna hurt for a little while. It's probably, I think, it's definitely worthwhile for the long-term health of the economy, but it's almost like resetting a bone.
The president addressed the tensions between the U.S. and Ukraine in his speech, and he quoted from a letter by Vladimir Zelensky following that now famous dust-up in the Oval Office. What do you make of the quick about-face from Ukraine? I mean, they're now saying they want peace, they'll sign the mineral deal. Has the president managed to get Ukraine back to the table?
Absolutely.
And why do you think that is?
Intelligence. I mean, the Europeans can talk about raising an army sometime in the distant future. Ukraine needs that money now. The Europeans can talk about spending more money, but they don't have it. And it's going to threaten their economies. They're already teetering. And at the end of the day, the U.S. cutting off the satellites, the Europeans can't replace that satellite intelligence. They can't replace the surveillance the United States has provided to Ukraine. They simply would literally have to launch a new space program in order to catch up. So when you lose that crucial advantage on the battlefield or it's suspended for a period of time, you have to come back to the table. Otherwise, Putin's going to end up dictating those terms.
The Supreme Court this week ruled that the Trump administration cannot freeze the $2 billion in funds already allocated to USAID contractors. Justice Amy Coney Barrett and Roberts both sided with the majority in this decision. This will certainly mean, Chris, that the grants received by the Catholic bishops for their migration and refugee service activities will soon be released. Your reaction to that?
It's a disappointing decision that the executive has no control over the executive spending. I think this is an ongoing fight. A lot of this is just being decided around the margins of technicalities. President Trump is pushing the boundaries here on what has become a completely bloated and out of control government where no one seems responsible except for left-wing nonprofits, et cetera, for actually how this money is spent. And the court seems to side with that, which is strange because Roberts is a strong supporter of executive power. Now, how exactly this is going to play out, how it will impact the bishops and the money that they have already spent on some of these services, will be seen over the next couple of days.
Yeah. Final question. Linda McMahon was just approved as education secretary. In one of her first missives to the staff, she encourages them to sort of walk with her on what she calls their final mission. It's believed that that is a subtle reference to the closure of the education department, which Trump wants. Your thoughts on that? I mean, this has been talked about since the Reagan administration. Is this a reality? Do you think it'll happen?
I think it'll happen. We'll have to see where it goes with the courts after that. The Department of Education doesn't actually educate anyone. Like the Department of Agriculture doesn't actually farm. What they do is they're a grant-giving organization, and they've been using those grants to back left-wing causes and an undermining of American education. It doesn't matter what city you live in. You could live in a prosperous suburb or a poor neighborhood, and either way, your children are less well-educated than they were years ago. Obviously, something has to change, and I think he's actually got the politics on his side on this one, which where the law will come down is going to be this is unprecedented territory.
Chris Bedford, we'll leave it there. You can read Chris's columns at theblaze.com. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And this week, I sat down with actor Jonathan Rumi on the Arroyo Grande podcast. We talked about season 5 of The Chosen, which is going to be released soon, and how Jonathan had reached a low point and was nearly broke when the actor abandoned himself to God. Watch.
I had got tastes of what a career could look like, but yeah, it never really panned out to anything beyond just an episode of television here and there. And then that day I experienced this financial miracle that to me was a sign that the moment I let go of the control that I had imposed upon myself, imposed upon my career, to try to be responsible for everything that took place, for everything that happened. The moment I let go of that and I gave it over to God, that's when things turned around, like that very day, in a very dramatic way. Mm. And then a few months later, I booked The Chosen, and here we are 5 seasons later.
Amazing. What's the takeaway for other people looking in on that? I mean, at times, those dark valleys are really where you find, you can't see the light except through a dark valley like that.
Right, right. I think the takeaway, Raymond, would be that you have to put your faith in something bigger than yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to really commit to an idea that's bigger than yourself. And for me, that was the divine power that is God in my life.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Jonathan Rumi is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts. We discover life lessons and examples to live by, offer some fun cultural commentary. You don't want to miss it. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Visit RaymondArroyo.com. All the links are there. Now, last year, we reported that McKenna, Max Sinise, the beloved son of actor and philanthropist Gary Sinise, had passed away at the age of 33 after battling an extremely rare form of cancer. Mac was a musician and a composer. For a time, he played drums in his father's band, the Lieutenant Dan Band. I recently sat down with Gary Sinise in Nashville to talk about Mac's struggle and the second volume of his recorded legacy, Resurrection and Revival, Part 2. Here's my interview with Gary Sinise.
Gary, I want to bring people up to speed. Last year, we talked about the release of your son Mac's music that you really brought to the world. He was instrumental in bringing it to the world. I want to go back to 2018. Tell me about the type of cancer that your son Mac encountered and how that brought his music to the fore, not only in his own life, but into your life as well.
We were sitting outside in our backyard. My wife had been diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer, and this was summer of 2018, and she had had some surgery, and now she was going into chemo, with several treatments of chemo, and the first treatment was very hard on her. It was really hard. I had to call the doctor, and he told me to bring her to the ER. We brought her to the ER. She was in the hospital for a few days after that first treatment. And then I got her home, and I was sitting in the backyard, and we were talking about, well, what are we going to do for the next treatment? How are we going to get through it? Earlier that day, we had sent our son Mac to see her spine surgeon. Moira had several spine surgeries.
Spine surgeries, yeah.
And Mac was having this pain in his tailbone, just sitting, just couldn't get comfortable. He was walking around with a cushion that he'd take to the restaurants and sit on it because it was hard to sit. A lot of pain. We had sent him to a primary care doctor who thought it was maybe a tailbone bruise from a bicycle accident or something like that. They did an x-ray on him. They didn't see anything. But he was having so much pain that that morning we sent him to Moira Spine Surgeon. I asked him to take a look at Mac and see what was up. So I'm sitting there with Moira discussing her cancer issue and what we were going to do. And I get this call from the surgeon, and he says Mac has a tumor on his sacrum. And he had put him in the CT scanner, and he sent him over to the MRI machine and then called me. And so I jumped in the car and went down to meet Mac at the MRI. We got the MRI and went back to the doctor. Mm. And then he put it up on the screen, and I could see this big, ugly tumor on his spine. Mm. And the doctor said, I think this is something called chordoma. And this is a very experienced surgeon.
Very rare cancer, too.
It's a rare, rare cancer. This is an extremely experienced surgeon, wonderful guy at Cedars-Sinai. He said, I've seen this before, but I haven't had a lot of experience with it. There's an expert in chordoma at UCLA who just recently moved out to Santa Monica from Boston, where he was at Mass General in Boston, and he's an expert in chordoma. Hmm. and removing these tumors from, you know, the spine. Yeah.
Mac goes in for spines.
Well, we went to this doctor, and then he said, he confirmed, sure enough, this was a rare cancer called chordoma. Maybe 300 patients per year are diagnosed in the U.S. with this. And he's had a lot of experience with taking these tumors off the spine, and quite often they can get all the cancer. They can take it off, and it's gone. And he's had a lot of success with that. But, you know, about 30% of the time, it comes back. Mm-hmm. And he took the tumor off of Mac's sacrum in September 2018, and 2019, May of 2019, you know, we went back for another scan to check things, and the cancer had come back, mm-hmm. and it was spreading.
And Mac, before that, had been a drummer, did gigs outside of your band and with your band, worked for the foundation. How did the music begin to come back into his life during this cancer struggle?
Yeah, he was an exceptional drummer. He started playing drums when he was 9 years old. He played all the way through elementary school and in the church band and then up into high school. He was in multiple bands in high school. And then he went to USC Music School, and he got into USC Music School as a drummer, but then started composing music and writing songs and conducting and, you know, experimenting with writing music for film and all kinds of stuff. His whole musical thing exploded when he was in college at this program. And so he would play with my band from time to time. I got one of the great drummers in the country playing for me, one wonderful guy, Danny Gottlieb. He's played for me for 20 years. I introduced him to Mac, him and his wife Beth, to Mac. They're both percussion drummers there in my mm-hmm. band. They were kind of mentors for him, and mm-hmm. so they were helpful throughout Mac's youth playing drums. Mac had some great teachers. And he would substitute for Danny when Danny couldn't play with me, yeah. and Mac would play. But then after the cancer thing happened, Raymond, you know, it became very, very difficult for Mac physically. I mean, the cancer started to really impair him to the point where he was paralyzed from the chest down. He had limited use of this arm. He could move the fingers on this hand, but he couldn't move the fingers on that hand. Wow. So drumming and music kind of just
faded into the background.
It pretty much did for a certain period of time because he was unable to do anything. He was fighting cancer.
Yeah.
It was the last year of his life. Last year, 2023, about February of last year, that he started thinking about revisiting a piece of music that he'd written in college and never quite finished. And he asked me if I thought one of my band members would kind of team up with him and help him flesh it out. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I think so, call Dan. And so he hooked up with Dan, who's my violin player. And they had worked together on some things before. Dan written some film music. Dan started helping him flesh it out. Then my piano player, Ben Lewis, started helping Mac flesh it out.
Was this what would become Arctic Circles?
Yes.
That's what it is, yeah. Which was on the first album you released.
It was the piece of music that started the whole musical journey last year.
Hmm.
That's where Oliver Schnake came into the picture. They were old friends from college.
Yeah.
Oliver happened to just out of the blue call Mac and say, how you doing? And at one point, Oliver said to him, hey, why don't we meet for at a restaurant or something like that? And Mac said, well, I guess you don't know. I'm kind of stuck at home. I can't walk. So Oliver said, I'll come over. And they started to rekindle their friendship and then talk about music. And then Mac played him a recording that they had been working on.
You had not heard that recording at that point?
Nothing. I hadn't heard Arctic Circles at all. And they went together to work together to finish it.
Hmm.
And then went into the studio, Sunset Sound, famous studio in Hollywood. They went in there July 17th. 2023. Mac picked that day because his sister was going to be in town. She was living actually here in Nashville at the time. We were still in California, and she was going to be in town then, so he picked that date because she was going to be there.
And the whole family really came together around it.
I brought my wife couldn't come to the recording session, but I brought my mom, and Sophie was there, and I was there, and it was, and Mac is there. There's videos of it where he's just working on the music, looking at the score, and he's working on the piece of music, and it, I was so moved by it. And that started a whole musical, what turned into a 10-song album.
He was very involved in the choosing of those songs, the creation of them, the expansion of what he had originally written in snippets, right? They were unfinished. Some of them were unfinished songs.
Well, Arctic Circles had a the base of it. You know, it's a piano-centered right. song. Mm-hmm. And he had written all the piano stuff.
I see.
So there was a real good yeah. solid base to work with there. Yeah. But then he and Oliver went to work on orchestrating it and... Mm. you know, creating it. So Oliver would make changes, send them back to Mac. Mac mm-hmm. would give notes, send them back to Oliver. Oliver would wrap it up. Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. They got into the studio with all these great,
beautiful,
outstanding
yeah.
musicians.
Incredible musicians, yeah.
Yeah. Just some of the best in Los Angeles came for this. And they recorded, on that day, they recorded Arctic Circles, and then Mac had started playing harmonica.
Yeah. Because he couldn't drum any longer because of the...
No, his mom recommended he get a harmonica. It was good for his lungs because his lungs were affected by the cancer.
Oh.
So, and he was on a, you know, he's on oxygen and all that. So it was good for him to play. But, you know, he's a musician. He wanted to keep doing music. So he taught himself how to play harmonica, watching YouTube videos and everything. And I gave him a video of a friend of mine, Medal of Honor recipient Sammy Davis, yeah. who plays Shenandoah so beautifully on the harmonica. And I gave Mac a video of Sammy playing it and said, you should learn this, Mac. So he did. And then I recommended, I said, hey, we're going to be in the studio. You're going to have all the musicians there. We're going to have time. You're going to finish Arctic Circles. Call Oliver and have him talk to him about doing an arrangement, a string arrangement to back
Shenandoah.
You up.
Yeah.
And so Oliver did a beautiful string arrangement, put Mac in front of the microphone, the orchestra behind him, and he plays this beautiful, it's something. It's very moving to see him playing with an orchestra. And those two pieces started Mac thinking, I want to do a whole album of songs. Mm. He wants to have a day with my band in the studio. So when we get to Nashville, we move to Nashville, and we set up two sessions in Nashville. And one of those sessions was with my band. He wanted to play with me. There's a song called Red River Valley.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm playing bass on it. Max... and they're playing.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful stuff, Gary. When you look at that, so I thought, okay, Gary's going to release this album. Our audience responded in incredible ways when they saw it. Not only on Fox, which I'm so touched that he saw that interview that we did together last Christmas.
Right before Christmas, we had this little viewing party where Oliver and his mom and dad came over and we ate food and we watched the videos. Mac had to be reclined, but he was watching the videos. And this is on December 28th.
Yep.
That morning, I had sent you Arctic Circles.
Yeah.
And said, because I know you're a musician, and you know, I just wanted you to hear yeah. it and see what. So you called me that day, that morning, and said, this is fantastic. Tomorrow night I'm on Laura's show. Can I feature this music and Mac's story a little bit? And I said to you, well, I'll have to talk to Mac. We haven't really talked about his cancer.
Right.
publicly. You know, it's just been between us, and I haven't really talked about it. So I went into Mac that right after that, and I said, Mac, you know, Raymond wants me to come on the show, and he wants you to come on, too, and talk about it, talk about the music and feature the music. And he said, really? Really? Yeah. And I said, you know what? It's going to be a five-minute segment. Yeah. It's going to be quick. I know how to bang out these answers real fast. Let me just go do it by myself, because then Raymond will have more time to play the music.
Good call, Gary.
And then I said, and Ray, you know, so I called you and I said, let's do it. You sent the satellite truck the next night on the 29th.
I remember.
I was out in the satellite truck doing the interview with you live, and Mac was in the house with my wife watching live. And I walked in after that, Raymond, and he was just beaming. I mean, his face, you know, the fact that his music was playing on national television, and you said such beautiful things. And then the next night, he was having trouble breathing, and we had to call the ambulance, and he went to the hospital, and he died 6 days later. You know, so that was a... But I'll tell you about the first 3 days in the hospital.
Yeah. He was so proud.
I asked you to send me the clip. When I was in the hospital with him, and I stayed with him in the hospital through this whole time. And for the first 3 days, he was starting to adjust, and he was doing okay. I was eating orange chicken with him. I was watching Seinfeld with him, you know, and he was feeling okay. And the nurses would come in, and then he'd say, hey, let me show you something. And he'd pull up that interview that I did with you and pop it and show the nurses, and he was just smiling away, and then he would... And then they would run off and look at the YouTube channel and watch the music, Arctic Circles and Shenandoah. Yeah. And then they would walk back into the room with tears in their eyes. And just and then he would just kind of...
beam.
He'd just kind of smile.
Well, I love that you were able to, with him, help him to bring this to completion and bring it to the public. We haven't talked about this, but when I saw that video, I thought, people need to see this. So I am delighted that I was pushy enough to get you to finally collapse, because he got to see it. And it's one of the little badges that will get me into purgatory, I hope, because it was such a beautiful and inspiring
moment. Look at the timing of those events that I just happened to send it to you at that time, and that you were going on Laura, and that you contacted me right away. Yeah. And that I could tell Mac, and then the satellite truck came, and then he's in the hospital.
Providential. You've continued to spread not only his music, but his legacy. Then you went into his devices, and this is where we pick up now. You went into his devices after Mac's passing. Tell me, A, what that was like and what you were looking for.
You know, after he died, you know, it's terribly difficult. Anybody who's been through that, loss of a child or something like that.
I cannot imagine, dear.
You're just searching and you're trying to figure it out, and how do I process things? And you know, I'm just bursting into tears at the drop of a hat, all that kind of stuff. And our whole family's going through that. And I took his phone. He had his phone in the hospital with him. You know, because I had brought in a bunch of things to the hospital for him to have. His phone was one of them that had the interview on it. You know, a book stand, his Bible, some things that he really loved. One of his harmonicas, I brought all that stuff. It was all in the bag. And when I came home from the hospital, I brought all the stuff home. I put it in my office. And then I just started going through stuff, and I picked up his phone and I turned it on. I know his password, and I got in there, and then I just started looking for things in his phone. And I started to find things. I started to find messages, things that he had written, thinking about what if something happens. I started going through his Dropbox files, and then I started finding videos. Some videos that he had made where he was just like late at night by himself talking about, I want you to know this and I want you to know that. Mm. And he left us things, because I think, you know, the year prior, he had gone into the hospital, into the ICU, and was in for 10 days with kidney failure and all this stuff that was going on with him. And he was thinking at that time, this could be it. So he started, that made him start recording things, writing things, leaving messages, all this stuff. So I found all that kind of stuff, and then I started to find music. Music that he'd written, tucked away. There was other stuff that he wrote that I'd never heard. And then stuff from college, going back to post-college, all this music. I found charts that he'd written that were never recorded. And I had my band kind of play the charts so I could hear everything. And all of a sudden there's like all this music there. And I thought, I can't just leave it here in the laptop, you know. There's all this beautiful stuff. I can't just let it be there. Fortunately, I could afford to take that music and do another record. And that's when I called Oliver and said, Oliver, I want you to come out to Nashville. I have more music that Mac wrote that I want to play for you because I'd like to do another record. And I'd like you to be involved in it. And I could see him just listening and he'd be going, oh, yeah. Ooh, wow. And he was just, he was digging it, you know.
Yeah.
And I knew why. I'm a musician. I know if it's good or not,
right.
You know. It's good music.
It's good
and,
music.
And so he was like, okay, let's go.
And so you knew you had Resurrection and Revival Part 2.
Yeah, I knew we were going to do another record.
This is a big album, Gary. Two LPs.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
how many songs?
There's two discs. There's 19 compositions on it, 17 original and two covers. One side is all orchestral music.
Right.
Mac really wanted to write music for movies.
Yep.
He loved movies.
Yeah.
There's one in one of the letters that he wrote, he was talking about his favorite movies. It's a Wonderful Life, one of his favorite movies. One of his other favorites was Forrest Gump. He loved Forrest Gump, and he talks about one of his favorite moments in Forrest Gump that really hit him and stands out to him is, remember there's a moment in Forrest Gump before we find out that Jenny is sick.
Right.
Where, you know, Jenny has had the little boy, and they get married, and there's a shot of Forrest and Jenny and the little boy walking down the road toward their house, and they're walking away from the camera.
Yeah.
And that, for some reason, that shot just really rang true to Mac. The family. The family coming together after all these things that have happened to both of them.
Mm-hmm.
They come together at the end. Then tragedy strikes, of course.
Mm.
But that moment really rang to him as the family, you know, the holy family there.
Yeah.
He loved movies and he wanted to write for movies. And he wrote all this orchestral stuff and all this other music.
He was a deep guy, and he didn't necessarily give you access to that. Did you have any appreciation for the depth of his talent or the breadth of it?
Oh, I had appreciation for it, but...
Or understanding of it.
I don't think I understood how good Mac was in terms of his composition and his writing, because he was very, very quiet and
humble
about it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, Dad, listen to this.
You got to listen to this. Sit down.
Yeah. He wasn't like that. He was, I think there was a part of Mac who he just always thought of himself as a drummer. And he was this sort of very humble composer, you know. But if you listen to some of his music, percussion is a big part of it. There's a song on the first album called Penguin Dance, and it's totally percussive and everything.
And quasi-love in this one. Yeah. Tell me about that song, which is his last composition, you think?
Yes, it's the last song that Mac wrote. I found a voice recording of him singing the melody into his phone. That, you know, I was searching his phone for all kinds of things. There's one called Sweep Sweepin'. It's a big band tune, and I have him going, and he's singing into the phone. And then I found the chart that corresponds with what he was singing. He wrote the chart up.
Wow.
Thank you. that particular tune you're talking about there, that was actually the last one he wrote. He's in his hospital bed. He was working on it, and when I said I had my violin player come and start working on Arctic Circles with Mac, when they were working together on Arctic Circles, Mac said, "Hey, I got this other thing. You know, maybe you can help me bang it out." And Dan started kind of working with him on it, but then Mac died, and you know, nothing happened. And I found the voice recording, and then I found a chart. And then I found some text messages between Mac and Dan talking about this song.
This song, yeah.
And so I went to Dan at our sound check on the next gig, and I said, "Dan, what is this song? Were you working on something with Mac?" "Oh yeah, Mac had these ideas, and he was, you know, we were starting to, you know, flesh it out and stuff like that." And I said, "Dan, you got to finish that song. You got to finish it for Mac, because we're doing another record, and I want to put that song on the record." And so what's beautiful about it is Dan did a great job, you know, totally with Mac in his head, writing out what he thinks Mac would see as a final product. And Dan sings on it, and it's on the YouTube channel, Mac Sinise YouTube. And then I thought, how cool would it be to bring his drummer roommates from USC and some of his guitar player music pals to have them come out and be a part of this song. So the drummer's on it, the percussion guys on the record are all his buddies from USC. They were all roommates together. The guitar players are guitar players that he played in bands with back in the day.
And Mac opens the track.
And Mac opens it. I decided to keep Mac singing into his iPhone as a beginning to the song.
Quasi love that you do. In some ways, this is like a mystery where you're uncovering these clues he leaves behind to really who he is on a deep level.
Yeah, it was like a treasure hunt.
Yeah.
I'm like finding all this treasure, and one after another.
And then there's Rise, which really is like an anthem for the Gary Sinise Foundation now.
It's beautiful. This piece that's on the YouTube channel, Mac Sinise YouTube, called The Rise, that was one of those that he composed for the Gary Sinise Foundation, but it was never used. We never used it. It got composed and kind of stuck in the file. And there's a few like that that are on the record. The Rise, though, is you could tell that Mac wanted to write. He loved Aaron Copland.
Yeah, it's very Copland-esque. It, John Williams. It's big.
It's like a very patent with timpanis and horns and strings and, you know, drums. And, I mean, it's a very patriotic anthem, and it's beautiful. He was writing this music for the Gary Sinise Foundation. We don't have the money to go into a studio and hire an orchestra to play it live. But Mac could do it all on his computer. So I said, "Oliver, take this. We're going to expand it, transpose it, get it all written out for all the players.
Get the parts.
And then we're going to go into the studio and we're going to record it." And Oliver did a beautiful job with that, and the rest of the music from the documentary called Always Do a Little More. So we took a lot of those cues, put them together into a suite of music called the Always Do a Little More Suite, and it's beautiful.
No, it's spectacular stuff. And I mean, I imagine Rise will become kind of the anthem of the foundation. I mean, when I heard it, I thought, this will be on every time there's a Gary Sinise ad or posting on social media. This has got to be your Netflix. Boom, boom. This has got to be your audio signal and brand. When I heard it, I just thought it's spectacular. Tell me about A Waltz for Addicts.
Yes,
he composed it when he was in college, right?
Yeah, this goes back to before Arctic Circles.
What's the source of this? What's Waltz for Addicts about?
Mac wanted to write for film, as I said. So he started composing this piece, and he wrote the piano part of the piece. And he played it for a screenwriting pal of his who was in the film program at USC. And she was knocked out by this piece of music that Mac wrote. He said, just listen to this, and it's the piano. He wrote out the whole piano part. Played it for her, and then she wanted to write a short animated film.
Animated film, yeah.
Which she did, and they called it Luna and Lars, and it's about these two puppets. And then Mac wrote the score, the entire score for the animated short, and the song that was originally composed just for piano, he added lyrics to it and called it Waltz for Addicts.
Or you will find there's no escape.
It's a beautiful kind of haunting melody, the animated short is very, it gets pretty dark, but then there's this very hopeful ending, you know, where they break loose of the things that are binding them and taking them out, taking them down, and it's really beautiful. The animated short is at Max Sinise YouTube as well.
Tell me about how prayer sustained you all through the loss of Mac. This had to have been a rough year for you and your family.
Well, yeah. Mac was very faithful Catholic, and very prayerful guy. And when you open his Bible, all these beautiful things are underlined, and it's almost like reading. When you read the scriptures that he was underlining, it's almost like just shooting messages. Yeah, and so sometimes I go into his room and I just sit down there and read it. He has confessions and that's underlined. Saint Augustine, he's got a Saint Augustine prayer book underlined. I mean, all those books are preserved right there in his room, and I'll go in there. I know that, you know, he would be studying scripture and his Bible at night when we were his best time of the day was after we went to bed. Then we prayed every night, before we went to bed, and quite often Mac wanted to do a prayer, and he would grab his Saint Augustine book, and he had seen the one that he wanted to do tonight. And we'd do something special. It helped. It's helped us all. You know, our faith has helped us all through. You know, we know every. You know, this is life, and people go through this kind of loss. You know, daily. So there's nothing unique about our situation.
But nothing prepares you for it. Either.
You're not. No. Was I prepared for this to happen? I never let myself think about. I was always in the fight.
Right.
Me as a dad, trying to protect my son and keep him so that he didn't have to think about the fight. So I was always looking for the doctors. I was always looking for the new medications. I was always trying to talk to somebody about some other treatment we could try. You know, it was always in the fight because I was not going to give up. But he never let himself kind of be consumed with what if this happens or what if that happens or why did this happen to me or all that stuff. Mac was never like that, so I wasn't going to be like.
No, he stayed on mission. I mean, he particularly at the end, he was so on mission.
Yeah, the last year of his life was in some ways one of the best years of his life for what he accomplished and what he got to do and what he got to leave for us and how he got to share it with his family and everything. And so he was motivating me all the time by just being this graceful warrior, you know, through this thing.
And on his 34th birthday, you release the second edition of his music. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, I picked a target date for when I wanted everything to be complete mm-hmm. for Resurrection and Revival Part 2. And I wanted it done by November 10th, which is Mac's birthday. November 10th of 2023, we were actually in the studio recording
the first.
We were recording the first record in the studio with my band, and that day we celebrated. And there's a video on the YouTube channel.
Harry Connick comes in, and there's hat party hats and the whole routine.
I mean, yeah, Harry Connick was there. He was recording in another studio there, and he popped in and then spent like an hour with Mac just talking about the music that he was doing. It was the most beautiful thing. So a year later, here we are, and I thought this will be a good target date to have Resurrection Revival Part 2 all completed as Mac wanted with the first record. All the proceeds from that record, the vinyl sales, go to the Gary Sinise Foundation. And so the vinyl sales from Part 2 are also going to the Gary Sinise Foundation.
Look, it's suffering. It's loss. I know that. But I love that you've turned it into something so beautiful and life-affirming and giving to so many people. And I hope you know that. And I'm sure Mac is smiling.
I am too. I think so too. He was a special guy. I mean, you know, we love our children, and you know, the fact that I could find all this music and then do something with it has given me this, you know, this motivating project to get through the grief. So, you know, sometimes I like to think that Mac did it on purpose. He said, Dad will find this music.
Right.
If I leave it over here, I know he'll find it. He'll need a project.
I thank you for bringing this project to completion for Mac and for bringing it to all of us.
Thanks so much, Raymond. Thanks for helping to get the word out. God bless you,
Thank
bud.
You.
Amen.
Thank you.
Resurrection and Revival Part 1 and 2, with music by Mac Sinise, arranged and produced by Oliver Schnee, is available now on a special vinyl-only edition from the Gary Sinise Foundation website. Visit store.garysinisefoundation.org. Per Mac Sinise's wishes, all proceeds from the vinyl of Resurrection and Revival Parts 1 and 2 will go to benefit the Gary Sinise Foundation. His father does such incredible work. You can hear both albums via streaming on Spotify. Well, that's all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. I know.